Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday, September 1st, 55 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giebel. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy Wednesday. We're halfway to the weekend. And we've been talking earlier this week that we were going to start to see some changes really yesterday, but those changes will be felt even more today. So for this morning, there are still some areas of patchy smoke. The air quality is not the best, but with that southwesterly flow, that's really beginning to kind of help things out. So we're looking at moderate air quality for today and tomorrow. But again, there will be more times of patchy smoke. But what we will really be watching out for will be the chance for rain increasing. So we start off today just with a small rain chance, and that's mainly going to come later this morning. But by this afternoon into this evening, it's scattered showers and thunderstorms. There could be some times of heavy rain. The rain chance just above 50%, right around 60%. So about a 2 in 3 chance that wet weather finds you if you're sitting in Park City for today. So not a guarantee, but if you're heading out the door this morning, maybe a good idea to throw the umbrella in the back of the car just in case. So as we go into tonight, the rain chance will start to go down a little bit as we turn towards the overnight, looking at more areas of patchy smoke during the daytime today, looking at low 70s for a high, low 50s for an overnight low tonight. And then tomorrow, we're going to start to see more of that moisture kind of move away from Utah, but we'll still keep a chance for isolated showers and thunderstorms. So about a 1 in 3 chance for rain for our Thursday. Temperature sitting in the middle 70s. Patchy smoke will continue to be around the area, and there will also be a little bit more sunshine to go around as well, not as much cloud coverage across the state. So Thursday night, scattered showers and thunderstorms still going to be a possibility, right around a 40% chance, but then that rain chance will really begin to die off heading into Friday into this upcoming weekend. So a small rain chance early in the day on Friday, then we transition to a mostly sunny sky, temperature still climbing to the lower 70s for a high. Then by Friday night, overnight low is going to be heading to right around 50 degrees. And then this weekend, it's looking quite lovely. Mostly sunny. Hopefully the smoke stays away, but temperatures will be in the middle to upper 70s, overnight lows in the lower 50s. And the weather that we get for Saturday and Sunday looks like it's going to carry over into Labor Day as well.
Okay, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. And coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Jeremy Ranch resident Marina Hudson, talking about her weekday COVID-19 emails. Then Park City Manager Matt Dias with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. Finally, Summit Community Gardens Executive Director Sloan Johnson with a Gardens Upstate. Stay tuned. 8:09 now. Good morning. Taking a look at some local news now. The resort economies of Park City and Summit County facing a workforce shortage in the wake of a pandemic. In response, the Park City Chamber Bureau hosted a panel discussion yesterday as representatives from local business, the city and county, and the state of Utah discussed the challenges and some possible solutions. KPCW's Rick Bruff was there and has this report.
The seminar drew about 40 attendees to the Sheraton Hotel. They heard from Park City Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer, who reported on what he's hearing from the business community. He said they're short-staffed, wages are rising dramatically for so-called back-of-house staff like waiters and dishwashers, and employers are often passing on the costs, which means, for instance, higher prices on menus. But he said the mood is resilient, not desperate.
They're incredibly challenged in that the outside economy, people who do construction and landscaping, there's so much growth and so much competition in that field. A lot of people that would typically work at a back-of-house place, they're working outside. They can get longer hours, they can get more money, and they just assume in the summertime be outside. So that was one of the three that really caught my attention. Again, back to the people are tired. Between COVID and the amount of visitation, we've really had no shoulder season. There's been no time to catch up. Everybody I talked to that was a GM or an owner, they're really tired. They've been cranking. And they're working like back-of-house shifts. They're doing, owners of companies are doing cleaning rooms and doing dishes. And I think it's just, we got to watch that one. Is it really sustainable?
Summit County Economic Development Director Jeff Jones said the pandemic accelerated trends the country has been seeing for years. A decline in fertility rates, working-age men dropping out of the workforce, women leaving jobs or careers to care for children or other relatives, and boomers taking early retirement. In response, Jones recommended that employers hang on to the workers they have, even if they have to pay more. He said it's more expensive to train a new employee. From the Utah Department of Workforce Services, Patrick Donegan and Worley Pace encouraged businesses to use resources such as the website jobs.utah.gov. One frustrated business owner asked about job candidates who don't show up for interviews or who ultimately turn down a job offer. Don again said employers can do something about that.
And there are actually repercussions now. If you report those people to unemployment insurance, if they turn down a comparable job to what they were making, they can actually end their UI benefits. That is something that's always actually been the case, but you're right, it is difficult because they're assigned a fraud investigator. And you can imagine how many, you know, cases are open right now, because that's what we heard all the time from employers. Like, I offered them this job, but I'm making 2 to 5 times more than what I was making before on unemployment. So we have a lot of dependency that's been enabled because of our government right now, just trying to throw money at the problem. You're absolutely right.
Steve Mullins, a staff engagement manager at Deer Valley, said worker shortages and impacts of the pandemic slam every employer, large and small.
We've seen a huge shift of workers from the hospitality industries into other sectors. Because again, there's a lot more concern about guests coming into our city and into our communities. We don't know if they're vaccinated or not. We might be vaccinated. You know, at Deer Valley, we're doing everything we can to protect our staff and our guests. But we don't know. And so a lot of people don't feel comfortable as they used to. And so they've moved on to other areas, other businesses, other regions of the country even.
Steve Mullins from Deer Valley, who said the resort recently raised the minimum wage to $15 for non-tipped employees, is examining other perks and benefits and giving candidates a chance to grow with the business. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
KPCW News Time now, 8:13. And stay tuned. Coming up on the Mountain Life right after the local news hour, today's guests include Dr. Russ Bradford, who has information on Park City Hospital's new pediatric unit for children who need overnight hospital care. Then, with winter just around the corner, Chad Bracklesburg of the Utah Avalanche Center has details about their upcoming 28th annual Backcountry Benefit, a great way to support the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Again, all of that coming up on today's Mountain Life right after the local news hour and NPR News at 9:06. Every weekday after 5 p.m., an email drops with today's Utah Coronavirus Daily Update. It's a data-filled email packed with today's highlights based on Utah reporting with a focus on Summit and Wasatch counties. The report is put together by Jeremy Ranch resident Marina Hudson, who joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me, Leslie.
Yeah, so why don't you start by telling us, Marina, who you are and what do you do besides preparing these reports?
I've been a military spouse since 1992, and So my background is in accounting and generally working different jobs, everything from temp work all the way up to I did corporate cash management for a while. And then ultimately I ended up with a branch of Navy Federal Credit Union managing that up in Brunswick, Maine. It was the furthest north that they had. The next one was in Rhode Island. So we had an awful lot of members that needed access to their funds, and I just found that highly enriching to work with the military service members and at the same time their families and explain complex data into a digestible form, or I guess distilling it. What I do in Utah now is I'm unemployed, been unemployed for quite some time, and coronavirus came along and found that there was some difficulties with getting accurate data from the state. The state early on was just publishing the totals each and every day. So to find out what had actually been the change was something that wasn't out there. And I didn't really care what people did with the data. I just wanted them to be informed on what was going on around us. So that's kind of why I did these in the first place.
Yeah, so I mean, a friend told me about these reports just, it's probably only been a month or so. And so I have no idea how long you've been doing them. When did you start?
Well, my first entry in my spreadsheet is back on the 20th of March, 2020. So I did daily updates all but, I think, 8 weeks this summer when things were just really, really slowing down and there weren't really many changes and I thought this whole thing was going away. So I actually contacted a university to find out if their grad students would be interested in my data set. And I have screenshots from each and every day that the dashboard at the state had updated as backup information. So, you know, I could see when things would change and when they wouldn't. But I started it, gosh, it's been quite some time.
Yeah, it sure has. And you say that you felt like you weren't getting enough, or we weren't getting enough information. So it's like, well, I'm going to provide that information. This has got to take an enormous amount of time to put together every day.
Yeah, it does. It takes a couple of hours. And then, of course, updating my spreadsheet so that I can do the weekly update and just kind of have it feed all over. And I'm just really a novice at Excel. So this is, you know, the old fashioned Excel 1996 brain teaching that has been adapted. I'm sure that there's a lot of ways I could make this a little easier, but I do it kind of the manual way. I don't download the data from the state dashboard. I just see what was actually out there, enter that data, and then I have, of course, have some check cells that I make sure that my data entry is correct. And if my data entry doesn't line up between the check figures, that's when I go back and research how that did this. So and the information that was out there update, when I first started these, it wasn't in the email form. It was actually using the Nextdoor app. And, you know, there was an awful lot of discussion out there on the social media of Nextdoor that was, oh, this is something, this isn't something, this is whatever's going on. It was just highly charged here in Park City from very early on. And I just was like, I could care less about the opinions. I could care less about anything like that. Just, folks, this is the change between yesterday and today. So early on in Nextdoor, and I did that until, gosh, March to September of 2020, and I would just post these updates inside of several entries in one thread, and every now and then people would turn it politicized, and so the thread would disappear, and then the thread came back, and you know, I had people from both sides of the political spectrum trying to tell me this way, that way, and I'm like, hey, listen, I'm reaching out to you, please don't, a lot of people depend on this data, please don't ruin it and have the entries disappear again because people use this information. And those people on the sides of the spectrum, they're still readers that are part of my distribution list. So and in September, I just had to get off the social media platform because it didn't make any sense to keep doing this and having people, you know, have their opinions. And I really don't care what people do with the data as long as they're informed and make their choices based upon informed information. That's all I really care about.
Yeah, so where are you getting the data from? I mean, is it just from the state, or where else are you checking to compile all this?
This is what's so cool about this. We are so lucky in the state of Utah to have this dashboard. We are one of currently seven states. New York Times recently had an article where they evaluated states that were providing breakthrough data, and one of the states is here in Utah. And breakthrough infections, of course, are those infections that are people that are at least 14 days post second vaccination, and Utah has been providing this data. So this is just one area where the state dashboard has been so good in revealing data. And originally I started this because I didn't understand how they were creating a positivity rate, and the math that they were coming up with just didn't align. So I started doing the math myself and going, okay, well, this is the one that I'm calculating and this is the one that they're reporting. And it's funny because then you can kind of see during trends and data coming from the state dashboard, how, like, when the positivity rate starts going up, all of a sudden, the positivity rate just kind of stays stagnant with the state data, but the calculated one that I'm doing on a regular basis is going up. So it's just some weird fluctuations and some weird behavior that wasn't necessarily a lapse in the state dashboard as much as maybe some sort of, I don't know, noise in my calculations. But yes, I get the data from the state coronavirus.utah.gov. I also go to Utah Department of Environmental Quality publishes the monitored trends within sewage treatment facilities here in the state of Utah. And that data actually precedes spikes in cases by about 1 to 2 weeks. I also visit SummitCountyHealth.org, and I look at what they're publishing. And I see sometimes that there is a discrepancy between what they're publishing as a positivity rate for 7-day average versus what the state is publishing as well. So again, there's noise between their two data sets as well. And I don't understand how that can happen because I believe the data either comes from Summit County and goes to the state or one way or another, they should be in alignment, but they usually pan out in the long run, but there's some short-term blips and differences.
So again, you're spending 2 hours of your day that you're never getting back here. I mean, what do you get out of it? I mean, are you actually getting paid now to provide this information?
Oh, gosh, no. This is a strange thing. It's just I would be analyzing and looking at the numbers for myself. Ever since high school and Sister Catherine, God bless her soul, who believed in me with math, I think that numbers don't lie. So one of the things that my husband and I utilize these numbers for on a regular basis is just, you know, looking at risk reward. We're constantly, especially not understanding the coronavirus, and it's constantly mutating, constantly changing. We think we understand it, and we tell people no masks, and then all of a sudden, masks again. It's because this is a wily organism that we will know in 10 years, and we will probably understand it a lot more in 10 years, but it's still relatively new that any published articles that are out there, New York Times, Washington Post, really anything that you have, people may say with certainty something about the coronavirus, but it keeps telling us that we don't really know everything. So I produce this data primarily to analyze it for myself and to just kind of know what risk reward to take today and what's going on in my town. Okay, well, I'm going down to, you know, Utah Valley, and what does it look like down there? Should I wear a mask today? Even when masks weren't required, I still would analyze and look at this. So I don't get paid for this. I get every now and then a few thanks from people, and I love hearing that, and I love hearing how they're utilizing this data and how it's helped them. You know, a lot of seniors subscribe to my emails, and I keep the email distribution list all on the BCC. I don't want anybody to feel politically pressured. I don't want anybody to feel like they're part of an organization or something like that, that they're going to be judged for this. I just want people to have information out there, and I'm doing it for myself to begin with, and then I just have readers that depend on me, and so I'm just following through with something I committed to for my neighbors and my neighbors in my neighborhood. And there's a lot of people in the Salt Lake Valley that are tuning in now too. So it's a nice thing that I do. And I guess it's my way of giving back to the community and in a way where I couldn't really get out in the community. So
yeah. Any idea how many people you have on your email list?
Yeah, I have slightly over 90 right now, and it fluctuates every now and then. A lot of people, sometimes they're bold enough, and I'm happy when they say, hey, listen, I'm just tired of this. I'm burned out. Can you please remove me from the list? And I have no problem. I remove them from the list. And then there's other people, they talk word of mouth, and they're like, okay, let's tune into this. What's going on? And they're like, oh my gosh, this is great. This is all the information. And it is a long email. It is a lot of data. And one of the things I tell people all the time is, you're not going to have to digest all the data at once, but you'll find, like right now during a spike or our current surge, that you'll tune into this thing right now. And then when we get into a lull, positivity rate doesn't really matter, except to monitor and make sure that there's still testing that's going on out there, that testing is being offered. So,
So besides this email, I mean, is this information getting published anywhere?
Not altogether in this little update. I don't think so. The ABC4 and KSL, they provide a change in daily information now, which is really handy, of how many positives. And recently they started getting emails from the state about how many of the new positives were school-age children, which is great because the state dashboard only provides data for the age group 1 to 14 and then 15 to 24. So 15 to 24 would include college, high school students, as well as young adults that are out in the workforce. So it's really not a good sort. So one of the things that the local media actually publish in their daily updates are how many people are in the hospital, the list of the decedents who just recently passed through COVID-related causes, as well as, you know, major statistical milestones like the total number of vaccinations right now. So the information is out there in a more condensed way. But the nice part about these emails is the fact that, you know, there are some people who are like, you need to do this part of data. Like, for instance, vaccines used to be really important earlier on in the year when there was just this vast demand for vaccines. And now it's not quite so important. But so it's all crowdsourced. It's people that come together and they like, have you looked at this? Have you looked at that? And for instance, Reader, SH, she initially, when I was posting on Nextdoor, she would post the list of the deceased who come through the ABC News, ABC 4 News, and KSL. And so when I went to emails, I decided to include that because these are people that are dying. These are our neighbors. These are our grandparents. These are, you know, people that we know, they're family members. And from a very, very early on, it was important to recognize that there was a human element to this as well.
Yeah. Well, if people are interested, how can they get on the email list?
Oh, gosh. I receive requests from people, please, to the email address. It's all been by word of mouth. I don't want to put it out there because I don't want to get spammed. I don't want to get... what would you recommend, Leslie?
Well, they can contact me, and I guess I could, you know, if they contact me directly at KPCW, then I could probably provide that email for you.
Yes, please. I would appreciate that, just because this is politically charged. I don't want people to, you know, call out things. They can they're more than welcome to get on the list. This is just all just data that's for everybody, and if you could, that would be wonderful. I just don't want to get, there's some crazy stuff that goes on out there too. There's some people that were just not happy with me providing just the data and they got off the platform, and that's fine. But, there's also the people who just really like to be well informed and what's going on.
Well, I get it. I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is like so much work. I'm always just impressed with the work you've put together, just putting together the numbers. So good job.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Marina, I appreciate you talking with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
And if you are interested in receiving her daily COVID-19 updates, you can send me an email, leslie@kpcw.org. KPCW News Time now, 8:29. Well, the Park City Council meets in work session Thursday starting at about 4:40 in the studio with a preview. Park City Manager Matt Dias, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Great, thank you. So first up, in work session, a discussion of the downtown trash and diversion request for proposal. So we've got a new contract coming up for garbage collection. The city basically wants to change how we do that?
Well, we're not sure. We think there's perhaps a great opportunity to align some of our sustainability goals as a community. I think we heard loud and clear during our Vision 2020 and some recent chamber surveys that there's a great appetite in our community to be more robust with regard to waste diversion in our waste and trash receptacles. So, for example, in our landfill, there's a 60% diversion possibility at our own landfill that perhaps we're not taking advantage of. And so going back to, about 2007, we've been working with the business district and sort of consolidating a lot of the trash and recycling services. And now that we have a contract up for renewal, we'd like to work with the business district to see if we can align some of these community values and make things easier and, you know, hopefully get more trash that could be diverted out of our landfill long term.
Yeah. So how does this fit then with the city's zero waste as a key strategy? I mean, is that even possible with just the number of people we have on Main Street?
I think it's fair. I said some skepticism there, and I think that's fair. I mean, this is going to be a very, very difficult challenge, but it's one that we're excited about, quite frankly. And I think we want to make progress in, and we want to walk the walk. I think, probably 7 years ago, it would have been laughable to think that we could consume so much of our future energy from a renewable source that the city has an offsite renewable solar farm that we're working on. And so I'd say anything's possible. The sky's the limit. But we can't let an aggressive goal be the reason we're not trying and making incremental progress along the way. I think it's important to understand the community values and the community goals and work towards them over time.
Yeah. There's been a couple of studies that are being done. I think we're still in the midst of those. What is it that those will show you?
Well, God forbid, it's actually sort of it's not an exciting exercise, and it really does take some hard work and labor where we have contracted with individuals that fully suit up in a hazmat suit and go through some of our daily waste and excess and trash receptacles to see what people are putting in the trash. So the amount of glass, the amount of recycling, the amount of food waste. And once you do this sort of waste analogy or waste assessment, then you can target the business owners, the excess that we're throwing out, and try to come up with new methods and new strategies to divert waste from our landfill.
Yeah, and we've certainly have talked kind of about the green waste, about whether or not that's something that we could collect. I think people can do it. You know, there's composters out there that people could sign up for that business. We've also kind of talked about... maybe a digester, right, which basically is an incinerator that burns the trash and creates I don't know, usable product?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, evidently, we're actually behind if you compare us to other municipalities across the country or even across the world, particularly when it comes to our waste and our trash and our recycling. And then Utah is also a little behind, quite frankly, compared to other states. And so I think the idea here is there a way to collaborate with our business district if we could be more aggressive in our waste diversion goals and the services that we provide? I mean, right now, I think what the community has done, at least in the Main Street area, is really smart. We've consolidated a lot of our trash and recycling services. And so if you've ever driven up and down Main Street, you probably don't even know that we have a big trash compactor across from our transit hub here, our transit center. And most people don't know that because it's designed well and it's covered. We also have several sort of we have several trash receptacles in some of our parking lots and other common areas that businesses are able to use and collaborate on together. So behind the house on Main Street in the business district is a very complex organism, and we're trying to make it better and improve it. We've got some sanitation concerns. You mentioned all the visitation, and clearly as visitation increases, so too do the burdens that go along with that. I mean, not only are we producing more waste, but we've got to build bigger receptacles and maybe a bigger trash compactor, and so we're trying to avoid those.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about sanitation. It's away from our view, but we can certainly smell it walking
by. You know, that's obviously an unfortunate byproduct. I think, just traveling around the country, we have done a fairly good job of it. I mean, I was out to dinner the other evening on Main Street, and the group of people that I was with, they had no idea that we had this trash facility here on the back of Main Street, because we do such a good job, I think, of maintaining it. That doesn't mean that it doesn't come with some bumps and blemishes along the way, but we are very, very proactive. We're in there several times a week cleaning it, power washing it, but this is the nature of the business, unfortunately.
Okay, so once this is all kind of figured out, I mean, does it mean then higher garbage collection rates for all city taxpayers, or is this just something that the commercial district's going to be liable for?
Well, I don't know if liable is the right word. I think so the first year or two, our real goal is to sort of step back and study and analyze and find out who's throwing out what and where and what could we take out of the landfill and how could it be repurposed and used, and then come up with a fee or a financial system to help pay for it. I could imagine a scenario where the city would have a common nexus or we want to partner in that, or the businesses would increase fees upon themselves. Backing up to 2007, the Main Street merchants requested that we enact a business improvement district to assess their own fee or levy an own fee upon themselves to help deal with this.
And was that done then, the business improvement district?
It was. So, going back to about 2007, it's around $250 a year. And it's, a big pot of money that's put together to work on the trash recycling goals and then to administer that program. Like anything, behind the scenes is a fair amount of contracting and procurement. And from time to time, pickups are missed or there's spilled trash and who's going to clean it up. So there's a fair amount that goes into it behind the scenes.
All right. Then at about 5 o'clock, council will discuss a master license agreement for what are known as SWFs. These are small wireless facilities in city right-of-way. And it sounds like, reading the report, that Senate Bill 189, the city must allow placement of these SWFs. So much for local control, I guess, huh?
Well, I think that's a fair characterization. This is one of those times where it's difficult to be in the public sector at the local level, where there's obviously a federal regulation. So water runs downhill, whether we like it or not. And there is a federal regulation that Congress enacted under the Telecommunications Act, believe it or not, back in the 90s. Subsequent to that, the state of Utah then had to enact its own legislation, and it was very permissive, quite frankly. It was very favorable to the industry. And so, Park City Municipal then has to come up with, in our opinion, sort of a belt and suspenders approach to try to eke every regulatory aspect we can to favor local control and make more stringent regulations where we can, but not violate state or federal law. Now, just to back up, this is very permissive. It is very, very favorable to the utilities. But we like to think, last time we talked to council and the community about it a little less than a year ago, we heard loud and clear that residents wanted us to give it the Park City hell, quite frankly. And we gave it all we got. So we have what we think is about as a strict ordinance as we could possibly have. We have a master license agreement in place. And we have a comprehensive set of guidelines, or design guidelines, that balance aesthetics, radio frequencies, where these can be put in the right way, you know, where they can be put vis-a-vis property lines, all sort of trying to be on the bleeding edge of not getting an appeal and violating state or federal law.
Yeah. So these SWFs are really the rollout of 5G internet services. I mean, it's basically that this is a faster service, but it's a shorter reach, so we need more of them. Many people, as you mentioned, are concerned with the levels of 5G radio frequencies. So in terms of what you do, you say you're really trying to make it as I guess, palatable as possible to those with health concerns. So what is it that the city does to make them safer? I mean, are they placed up higher so they're out of, away from where we walk by, places we gather?
Well, it's a pretty comprehensive strategy, and it's very, very nuanced. So I would encourage anyone that is interested in this to please look at the staff report that we provide. It's a very, very comprehensive staff report, and the design guidelines are very specific about where these can be located in the rights of way, what they can look like, how far apart they can be. You know, the interesting thing, you know, that you mentioned is every time we sit down with the provider, I'm asked to pull out my phone, to which they make me open my phone and they determine that I'm running on 5G service. And so it's a little bit of a conundrum that, you know we need this now in our virtual environment, yet no one wants these outside of their homes. And so we're trying to balance these the best that we can. But, you know, we are going to have a measuring program in here. And so council will likely consider how many times a year they want the municipality to measure where these new small wireless facilities are located for radio frequency. That's something that we can do at the local level to ensure that the telecommunications companies are adhering to federal and state law. So it's a blended approach. It's having strict guidelines up front about where and how and when these can be located, and then monitoring and measuring them along the way to make sure they're adhering to state and federal law.
Okay, again, this discussion, and you will take public input on it, is happening Thursday at 5:00 there in the City Council chambers. During the regular meeting, Council will get an update on the no dumping storm drain decals. Again, I'm guessing that, you know, a storm water fee increase went in several years ago, so you've kind of got a pot of money. Is this just part of the education of that?
It is indeed. So if you've been around town lately and you've been just walking over manholes or storm drains, you've likely seen these new colorful decals, which hopefully help educate the public and make sure that commercial entities and residents or contractors aren't dumping materials and waste into our storm drains, because they do lead into our streams and our ecosystem and our water system. And so this is part and parcel of that program. Now, we have all sorts of other equipment, vector trucks, and we're cleaning our storm drains, and we have different types of regulations with regards to when we have a hazmat spill or a construction site, but this is one component of that program.
All right. Is it still a problem, people dumping?
It is, believe it or not, from time to time. I think proactively through our construction mitigation plans, we've been able to eliminate a lot of that. We've elevated, obviously, our equipment for cleaning and swaddles for when we have a hazmat spill or something like that. But we've also just enhanced the education around the community. And believe it or not, you know, an ounce of education can go a long way. And so we have had a lot more compliance than we have historically.
All right. Then a Park Silly Sunday Market mid-season update. I mean, what can you say? How's it going so far?
Well, gosh, the takeaways are just another very, very successful season by almost any measure. I probably sound a little bit like a broken record, but you know, the Park Silly vendor is one of the more professional, knowledgeable vendors that we're able to work with. And as you know, we're working with all sorts of vendors, whether they're music or festivals or art and operations. And so these folks do a wonderful job collaborating with the city, and they have a very, very strict contract about performance deliverables and measurements of their sustainability goals and quality mix of vendors and attendance. And by all measures, this is just another very successful season with a very competent vendor that we enjoy working with.
Yeah. And then we saw the cancellation of this year's Song Summit yesterday. Again, mostly happening outdoors. So how is Silly Sunday any different than a three-day festival?
Well, and I think that's a fair question. You know, obviously, we're working closely with the Summit County Health Department you know, I didn't think we would be where we are a year ago today, to be honest. I think we're all a little disappointed and a little heartsick about the fact that we're on a high level now with the Summit County Health Department and transmission rates are increasing. So as a municipality, we've obviously ratcheted up our services, but I think vendors like Park City and others are beginning to think about contingencies and, you know, what will happen if Summit County has to implement stricter measures. I think people are preparing for it. But again, if you've been to the Silly Market, you know, at every entrance and exit, they've got PPE and masks, and they're encouraging, you know, people to take precaution and try to spread out. But obviously the conundrum is it brings a lot of people into a small area every Sunday. But we are going to follow the Summit County Health Department. And so I don't think you've seen us act or Park City act until we sort of get that notification from the Summit County Health Department. But we're on high alert, absolutely. I think, again, just a step back, we're disappointed to be where we are. I didn't think that this would happen, but we have to prepare for it, obviously, and we're trying to do that.
All right. Council will also be asked to approve some temporary artwork for the Arts and Culture District. What kind of artwork are we talking about?
This is kind of a cool idea. So our staff has worked with the Summit County Community Arts Council and the Public Art Advisory Board. Those are both mouthfuls. One is obviously through the Summit County lens, and the other is through the Park City Municipal lens, where our council has an advisory board on art. And they'll be doing some activation, temporary activation in the Arts and Culture District. So it's under the monikers of sort of cubes, courts, and panels. And I had to get educated on that myself, but cubes are sort of these textiles and other sort of boxes that will be able to be movable and will be able to be transported around the district in different areas, and people can kind of touch them and move them and roll them over and see a different picture. And then there will be some sort of like panels and graphics on the ground that people will be able to walk over and see, and that's a neat element. And then finally is there sort of this like this panel aspect, which is this art in motion. So we'll be having a lot of local artists, many of which we know or they're our neighbors, will be coming down and doing sort of art in motion at certain times. So you'll be able to watch them, watch their muse, watch their art take place, or even contribute and help them with that. So sort of three different aspects of it, and it should be a fun exercise.
Yeah, I think council approved about $150,000 kind of for the activation of this area.
Yeah, I mean, I think the majority of that was sort of site preparation and suitability, which is just making sure you have chairs and restrooms and some shade and lighting in certain areas. The team sort of did a soft rollout last night where they had some local musicians play using PC Muse. Bill McGinnis and Shannon Runyon were there. And so, you know, some chairs and tables and some lawn games. But you'll see hopefully the activity grow over time. And we think there's some good overlap with our Transit to Trails program. So the parking for our Transit to Trails program, which we've talked about before, is directly adjacent to this area. And so hopefully it's a place that people can ride Transit to Trails, can hang out afterwards, have a bite to eat, work with a local musician, bring their kids, and enjoy the space.
So it's kind of opening as a gathering spot already then.
It is indeed.
Yeah, so is there some kind of schedule people can see or?
There is, and I think it's going to be on the PC Engage website, but I'll have to get back to you on that. But that's a good point. And what we've been doing thus far is we've been pushing it out on social media and making announcements that way about who the artist is and, you know, when the performances will take place. But we absolutely need to get that up on the website.
Okay. Council will also be asked to approve the Historic Park City Alliance temporary chalk art project on city property. Again, we saw a little bit of this. We saw it washed away. Somebody just thought they were doing their job, cleaning things up. But we're going to see some more of this before the snow blows?
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Obviously, we had a mishap earlier this year. We had an artist come up, and we were just talking about the trash compactor here on Sweet Alley, and where they had put their art was right below that. And when we were cleaning it with a power washer, the whole thing kind of ran away because of the water. Nonetheless, we were very apologetic, and we wanted to make sure that we got that artist back up to Main Street so that artist will come back and have an installment. And then there's three or four additional installments on the top of Main Street, particularly on Sundays, to try to create some additional activation. And most of these artist installments are about sports or our history or other types of things, and they'll be up towards the Egyptian store, that sort of top Main Street area, to bring some activation up to the top of the street. It's a good collaboration with the Main Street Merchants and HPCA. They actually procured this endeavor, and we've been very supportive of it. They clearly need some aspect of the right of the way to make it happen, and we're excited about it.
Yeah. So have requests like this changed at all as a result of last year's Black Lives Matter murals on Main Street that just really upset a lot of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 2 years ago now, gosh,
yeah, right.
now that I was thinking about it on my drive in. Yeah, I think we pay far more attention to it, to be perfectly honest. I think we're a lot more sensitive to it. That's the reason that sort of just by default, we throw these two items on the agenda where we may not have to technically do that. I think we want to make sure that we understand that we struck a nerve. People are very sensitive about it. I think the neat thing about both of these exercises is, one, we're collaborating with our Main Street merchants to bring activation to the top of Main Street for those businesses that have felt that the top of the street isn't activated enough. And then the other is to activate an area with local artists, you know, the real sort of local artists in the Arts and Culture District that are our neighbors and are our colleagues and our coworkers often in this town. So, yes, we are more sensitive to it. We clearly pay more attention to it. We struck a nerve, and so we're just trying to be more proactive. I think, you know, that's the reason you saw us engage the Public Art Advisory Board way ahead of time and engage the Summit Arts Advisory Council, just to make sure all the stakeholders are included.
Yeah, so is somebody kind of reviewing the proposed artwork before it's approved?
Well, so great question, but so both the Summit Arts, and I hope I'm saying this right, because if I'm not, Jocelyn's going to just kill me.
Park City Summit County Arts Council.
There we go, so please correct me if I'm wrong. But and then the Park City Art Advisory Board, both of them have reviewed it ahead of time, and those are advisory boards, in my opinion, particularly ours at the Park City level, that can screen and filter. And they, you know, obviously host our collection, and they make recommendations to the city council. And so they've done that here.
Okay. Finally, just wanted to ask about the sale of the affordable housing unit there in King's Crown. It will be sold as affordable?
That's correct. My understanding is it's just a conversion from a rental unit. The covenants of the original development had this as being a rental unit or a for sale unit. At the time it was a rental unit, but it was sort of always contemplated as a good opportunity for the on-site property manager or the sort of custodial services and property management services of the building. And so that individual is actually living in this unit and then seeks to purchase the unit to have some equity as opposed to being in the rental side of things.
Yeah, sure. And I guess, I mean, have all of the units that were built as affordable or attainable, I mean, they have remained from day one? Because I recall the developer coming to the council asking to transfer one or more of the units to market rate.
No, I don't have my numbers in front of me because this, to your point, has gone back and forth several times. I think to summarize at a very, very basic level, the developer met their affordable housing obligations out of the gate. Period. Hard stop. Then in addition, the developer had offered some moderate or median income housing as a different tranche of housing that they could provide as a community benefit. Unfortunately, that tranche that you know wasn't required, they weren't able to sell it. And so what we did with them is we allowed them to bring those up to a market rate, but then pull back two of them to add to the housing, to the affordable housing inventory. So to take a step back, the developer met their affordable housing requirement out of the gate, hard stop, and then they've subsequently added, I think it's 2 or 2.5 units of additional affordable housing for the conversion of a non-requirement moderate or median income to a affordable unit. So long term, we gained more affordable housing out of this, but we sort of lost on this medium income, middle income housing thing where either the price was too high or it was the wrong location. And I think, you know, hopefully the grand scheme of things is that, you know, it was transparent. They went to the city council, they went to the Affordable Housing Commission, you know, they went through all the steps and have met their requirements.
Okay. And if, I guess I just think a lot of people would go, we couldn't sell. I mean, there's just not a market for ski in, ski out at kind of a median price.
Well, and I think the problem was that the incremental increase year over year was under some type of a restriction. And so there was concern about, you know, laying down that amount of money and then having your equity capped at, you know, 3% a year or whatever the year over year cap is. And so when you get more towards that middle income or higher income quadrant, it becomes less of a desirable, capital outlay for an individual.
Okay. Hey, Matt, anything else?
I do have one other thing, is that because of the high transmission rate of Summit County, we are moving Thursday's meeting online. And so perhaps I should have started with that, but we will make sure that, you know, we push that out on social media and that we're putting that on our website. But if you could help us, let people know about that, we'd appreciate it. Obviously, it's just a reaction to be proactive, try to lead by example to the public. But because the transmission rate increased, we are asking people to attend our meeting online, and council will be meeting online. Our hope is, you know, although we do like meeting in person and it clearly has a better, you know, provides a better connectivity and sometimes a deeper discussion, it can provide better access to the public. So we have those two work session items that we were talking about trash and the small wireless facilities in particular, are things that people may want to tune in for.
Okay, Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Be talking with Sloan Johnson from Summit Community Gardens right after this. Well, the Summit Community Gardens is hosting an after-school program for our local students. On the phone with details, I have Executive Director Sloan Johnson. Good morning, Sloan.
Hey, Leslie. How are you?
Good, good. So starting next week is when the programs start. Who is this for? What ages are we talking about?
Yeah, so we have our after-school program for elementary kids. So it's grades first through fifth. And it's Monday, Wednesday, Fridays after school. So Monday and Wednesdays, 4:30 to 5:30, and Fridays, 1 to 3. And you can, for this after school program, you can choose one day or do all 3 days.
Okay. It's going to run for 8 weeks, running again September 8th through October 29th. What's the cost?
Yeah. So it's $420 for all 21 days. Or you can do $175 for just one day a week for the whole time.
Okay. So what kind of projects will the kids be doing?
Yes, we have lots of fun things planned. They're all going to be working in the garden. They'll all have little jobs that they'll be responsible for throughout the time that they're there. We're also partnering with Planet Earth First. So the kids will be able to do a little bit of woodworking to build birdhouses and bee hotels and some other fun things for the garden. We're going to have Hawk Watch come. So in October, we have Migratory Bird Week. And so we're going to celebrate that by bringing Hawk Watch, and they're going to bring some raptors for the kids to learn about and learn about the importance of migratory birds. We'll also have an entomologist come and talk about the bees and pollinators, so they'll get to learn all about that. We have cooking activities, so they'll be able to harvest from the garden and do some cooking activities as well. So, and then we also will have Randy Joe coming in for a couple days to do some yoga, so they get a little bit of everything.
Okay. Also, coming up next week, September 7th, you've got another class, Soil Health 101. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So we've invited Megan Lewis and to do a soil health class. So Megan has her master's degree in plant science, and she works for USU. And so she's going to be coming down to the garden and talking about soil health. And what kind of soil you need and how to have the best soil for your vegetables and sort of the best crop production. And the fall is the best time to work on your soil. So what you need to do to amend your soil before the winter so that you're prepared for the spring.
Okay. And again, it's free. Do you just need to register?
Yes. So just register for this class, and it's a free class.
All right. And then coming up on September 16th, it's Interactive Music in the Garden with the Red Desert Ensemble. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this is a great event. So Red Desert Ensemble, Katie, local musician Katie Porter and Devin Maxwell are part of this ensemble. And right now they're touring in Europe. And when they come back, they're going to be doing a concert for us. It's a very innovative music, probably nothing like you'll hear anywhere else. And the fun thing about their show is they'll bring you up and have you be a part of the music that they're playing. So last year when they came into the garden, they had everybody with their own kind of percussion instruments doing crescendo, decrescendo, and playing. And it's really cool when they're out there playing their music, you know, just the way you can see the way the animals react in the garden. And, you know, we had a lot of birds coming in and, you know, just noticing what's happening in the garden while they're playing. Their music's very slow and, you know, it's a lot of fun. So this is a free event, and I recommend coming to check it out. Please sign up online if you're going to come, so we know how many people to expect. But we want everybody to come check out Red Desert Ensemble.
Okay. Again, that's September 16th, 5:30 to 7:30. And then
Yeah.
Miner's Day Parade. You're looking for plot owners to join you in the parade?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all plot renters are welcome to join us in the parade. We're also going to have a booth at the Miners Day Festival down at City Park. And so we'll have fun planting activities for the kids and more information about the garden if you're interested in getting involved. You can come see us at the City Park on Miners Day and learn more about Park City Community Gardens.
Okay, and you've got your garden stand up this morning. How long do those continue?
Yeah, so most of our harvests we're donating to families in need, but we do have some that you can come by at our farm stand from 9 to 11. And that'll go until mid-October, just depending on the harvest.
Okay. Anything else, Sloan?
No, that's everything. Thank you so much, Leslie.
Sloan Johnson is the executive director of the Summit Community Gardens. Thank you. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time Now, 8:58. And after canceling last year and with many months of planning this year, Park City Song Summit organizers have made the difficult decision to pull the plug on this year's event that was set to start in about a week. The news of Song Summit's postponement came yesterday. In a statement, Song Summit founder Ben Anderson said, with ICUs at 100% capacity, Summit County jumping to a high level of COVID-19 transmission, and the county matching its single-day high for new positive cases, he didn't think the event could be held safely. This is the statement I never wanted to write, he said, but it's what the current COVID climate has required us to do. Song Summit was canceled in 2020, as nearly every other large event was as well. And while it was looking better for this year, Anderson said that after countless conversations with top health officials, infectious disease experts, and local government, he didn't think they could hold the event safely, even though the majority of it was going to be outdoors. Even with extensive precautions being taken, Anderson said it still wasn't enough to overcome the risk of a dangerous COVID-19 spread. Song Summit is planning to reschedule the event for September 8th through the 11th next year. Refunds for this year's festival will be issued within the next 14 business days. They recommend people follow Park City Song Summit on social media to get the latest updates. Coming up now on 9 o'clock, stay tuned for NPR News, followed by The Mountain Life. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.